KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi's government is in increasing peril today. A half dozen of his government's top officials stepped down and three government spokespeople as well. We'll have more on Egypt just after 10 o'clock. Also, gardening coming up in the next hour. We have just one word for those of us living in the Puget Sound region: hot. Really hot, so hot that we reached a record-breaking 89 degrees at SeaTac Airport yesterday. As you heard, forecasters say cooler weather is on the way, but that didn't help yesterday. KUOW's Ruby DeLuna was out and around to look at how people were coping with the heat. She has this report.
The Judkins Spray Park in South Seattle is busy. Deborah Coleman runs a daycare in the neighborhood. She brought her clients here and says this is her go-to spot on hot days. In addition to water, Coleman names off her essentials for keeping cool.
Shade, sunscreen, and some snacks to keep the kids happy.
Coleman says the kids are getting their playtime earlier so they can avoid the afternoon heat.
When it gets up to the 90 degrees, we tend to be inside with the fans, you know, because that heat for the kids is not really good. So,
health officials recommend that people stay inside when it's hot. And if you have to be outside, limit your time in direct sunlight. John Turnbull owns Turnbull Landscape. Today, he and his crew are finishing up a job in Montlake neighborhood. Working outdoors is usually a blessing, but not today.
In this kind of heat, it's a curse.
Turnbull says he tries to stay hydrated. Today, he started his day 2.5 hours ago with a gallon of water.
And I'm down to half a gallon now.
Turnbull says he doesn't bother wearing a hat because most of the time he's crawling under bushes. Seattle doesn't experience hot weather very often, so many people find it hard to adjust to the heat. Beverly Emerson doesn't mind it. She and her husband are visiting from England. They were cooling off with ice cream in Ballard.
It's lovely because we had such a long winter that was cold. So it's brilliant to see the sun and blue sky.
Sunny skies are expected to continue through the week, but weather forecasters say it'll cool down gradually. Seattle libraries and community centers will be open for people seeking relief from the heat. I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
We'll have another look at the weather a little bit later this hour when Michael Fagan joins us, talk about some hikes and what the weekend forecast is. Dr. Greg Foltz dedicated more than 25 years of his life to brain cancer research and treatment. He was director of the Ivy Brain Tumor Center, and he founded Seattle's annual Seattle Brain Cancer Walk. He even treated some of our region's most recognized brain cancer patients, Pat O'Day and Kathy Gertz. And Katie Sewell joins me now. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Marcy. Sadly, Dr. Foltz died last Thursday, shortly after receiving a pancreatic cancer diagnosis. In remembrance of Dr. Foltz's work researching brain cancer, I wanted to replay part of an interview that Steve Scherer did with Dr. Foltz and Dr. Anthony Blau in 2011. Steve started by asking Dr. Foltz to give us an outline of how brain cancer works.
If you think about brain cancer, you really can divide it into two different types: cancers that come from the cells of the brain itself, and that's what most people think of when they hear the word brain cancer. Primary brain cancer, which is cancer that comes from the brain, it's one of the greatest challenges that we face in medicine today. You captured the numbers about right. The average survival is just a year and a half. There's 22,000 people that are diagnosed, and half of them will die during the course of the year, and that's very, very sobering for patients. I think when you think about how we approach this disease and the way I certainly approach patients is to keep in mind that there are always advances, and certainly we're very hopeful about some of the things that we're doing right here in Seattle that we think hold great promise for these patients. And even though the numbers on the internet are quite sobering, the reality is we're doing better than that, I believe, in individual patients today. And I hope we can capture some of that here in the discussion.
Well, part of your argument and what you're looking at is that individual patients, because these tumors are individual, each individual could be, they're a one-person research project in a sense.
That's right. You know, one of the things we're very fortunate about with this disease is that the National Cancer Institute decided to make this cancer one of the cancers in which they would do in-depth genetic analysis of individual patients' tumors. And they did that on about 500 different patients. And what they found is that there's a tremendous amount of heterogeneity or individualization of each tumor. Every patient basically has a unique genetic signature. But of course, when you look at hundreds of patients, you're able to group them into groups of patients in which they have enough in common that you can start to make predictions about how they'll potentially respond to therapy or what therapies might work better in those patients. And that's really where we are, right on the brink of that era where we're going to be able to rationally decide which therapies might be best for a group of patients or even for an individual patient.
Well, how is brain cancer different from other forms of cancer, or is it very similar?
So I'm increasingly impressed with how many similarities there are across different cancer types. Some of the proteins that are active in certain cancers are actually end up being shared across cancer types that you wouldn't have initially predicted. So, for example, Herceptin, a drug that's used to treat a certain form of breast cancer, turns out to work in about 20% of patients with stomach cancer.
Are these proteins that are unique to cancers, to tumors?
They're not typically unique. There are certain unique proteins that you can target, but just making the analogy to antibacterials and antibiotics for the treatment of any sort of infectious disease, there you really have targets that are novel to the thing that you're trying to kill. In cancer, these targets oftentimes are not unique to the cancer. They're also present in normal cell types. And the real challenge then is to use a much more sophisticated approach to really understanding how to target those aspects of the tumor that are uniquely driving the tumor while sparing normal cells. So it's kind of the same paradigm that's applied in infectious disease, but requiring a much greater level of sophistication and really being able to optimally exploit the targets that are specific for a particular tumor type.
Is that because the tumor is harnessing the proteins in our bodies to do the work for it?
Sure. Yeah. As Greg just talked about, there are many, many different ways to make a cancer out of a normal cell, and different cells use different strategies. And figuring out what a particular cancer is doing in a particular patient and then exploiting that for the benefit of that patient while at the same time trying to learn about how cancer behaves, I think is really the grand challenge. Tumors differ dramatically between different patients, but a single tumor within a single patient is actually comprised of a whole, you know, host of different subtumors that have specific mutational complements. As evolution works, if a single cell has a mutational complement that allows it to escape your treatment, it will grow out again. That really is one of the real challenges in treating cancer, is to understand what that mutational complement and heterogeneity, how that works.
I've to follow up on that, I've heard it described as a moving target, and I think that's really fair. These tumors will evolve and change or mutate in response to our treatments. Of course, the tumor cells are selected out because they survive whatever treatments we give. But there's a real clue there as to how we can beat this disease. We all have this experience where we'll take care of a patient who's 10 years out, 12 years out from a diagnosis, for instance, of breast cancer, and then they'll show up with a single tumor in the brain. That's the patient I would see. You know that that cell has survived all that time, 12 years since their initial diagnosis, coexisting in that patient's body, but not causing a tumor until all of a sudden it changes in some way that allows it to take root and cause a tumor. So I believe that durable treatments for cancer really involve controlling the growth. We probably can't eradicate it completely, but if we can prevent those cells from taking root, patients are going to be fine and they're going to live their normal life. So it's really preventing the recurrence of a cancer that I think is the first entry point, at least for brain cancer. I can remove the tumor, as I like to say. It's the cells that have wandered off, that have the capacity to form the tumor to recur, that are the reason our patients don't survive. If we can keep those tumors from recurring, then we have a real chance to make a difference. And so we're really focused at that particular nexus. I think if we can solve that problem for 80% of my patients, we'll have a durable treatment. And that's really the challenge.
Is there something about the brain cancer that makes it more or less following that path that you described?
Yeah, well, I'm a big advocate. I think brain cancer should be the first cancer that's cured in this fashion. Brain cancer never leaves the brain. These cells that wander away from these tumors don't cause tumors to grow in the lung, the liver, the bone, like other cancers. When that tumor comes back, it's going to come back in the brain. And 85% of the time, it comes back right where I removed the tumor. So those cells haven't wandered very far. They're just in the neighborhood. Well, there's a lot of theories. These, I'll give you my view. Some people think it's the blood-brain barrier, that the cells can't get out of the compartment where the brain and spinal cord exist. I personally think that the cells don't survive. They can't take root. They may get out into the blood, but they can't take root in these other organs. And the evidence for that comes from patients who are immunosuppressed for, say, a kidney transplant that have been found to have a brain cancer that can grow in other organs of the body. So I think these cells are very vulnerable. I don't think they can take root outside the brain. Plus, the brain is a very protected space. If we can get the drugs delivered into the brain space, you can get very high concentrations there without having to worry about getting the drug delivered to the rest of the body. So these are the things that make me hopeful. The key is identifying which drugs are going to work for these cells, which are the single cells that have wandered off from the tumor that have the capacity to cause the tumor to recur. We call these cells tumor stem cells, and I think they're the real target that we ought to be going after.
Why do you call them tumor stem cells?
They're called tumor stem cells. Some people will call them tumor-initiating cells, but what we think, and it's a theory, is that there are certain cells within the tumor that have the capacity to cause the entire tumor to recur, even potentially from a single cell, but certainly from a few cells. And these cells are very similar in their capacity to cause other cells to grow to form the tumor to what we would call a stem cell in the normal condition. So they are called tumor stem cells, but there are many people in the field who say that that creates a lot of connotations that we don't want, and so we can call them tumor-initiating cells. But the idea is that a single cell has the capacity to not only make a copy of itself, but also to make a copy of or a new cell that can reconstitute all of the cells that constitute the tumor. And the intriguing idea is that it really represents just a small fraction of these cells. So I can take a tumor out. We do this on every patient. And we take the tumor up to the lab, and we isolate these tumor stem cells. And when you inject these little tumor stem cells into an animal, say a mouse, they'll cause the whole tumor to grow quite rapidly. You can take the non-tumor stem cells, we'll call them, the other cells of the tumor, inject those in the mouse, and a tumor will never grow. So it's very interesting that the cells that seem to be the problem represent just a small fraction of the cells that we've been studying. And I think that's why it's such an exciting theory and also an exciting target for developing new therapies, because they appear to be so different and potentially would respond to different drugs.
On Weekday, we're talking about brain cancer, who it affects and how it's being treated, and new techniques for treating brain cancer with Dr. Greg Faltz, who's a neurosurgeon at the Swedish Neuroscience Institute and director of the Ivy Brain Tumor Center, Dr. Anthony Blau, who's co-director of the University of Washington's Institute for Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine. Let me turn to a personal story and how brain cancer is treated in the hospital, how people are dealing with it. Candice Becker O'Hara is a clinical nurse coordinator in neuro-oncology at Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. Thank you for talking to us.
Yes, my pleasure.
What's the hardest thing for you working with brain cancer? Is there a difference between brain cancer patients and other patients?
I think the hardest part for me is knowing eventually that you will lose them. With a lot of cancers, you know that there is the opportunity, there is the hope that you will win through, power through, and you have that glimmer of hope. And with the brain cancer patients, you will, for the most part, have to say goodbye.
Do you have to prepare them for that, or are they helping prepare you?
Both. It's a dual road.
How did you get involved in this part of your work?
My aunt died from a glioblastoma, so it's a personal road.
And I understand that that's your case as well, Dr. Faltz, that you had a friend's daughter?
That's correct. Actually, my friend, when I was in my early 20s, someone I was very close to died of GBM. I actually wasn't even in medicine at the time. I was doing something completely different.
You were playing piano.
I was.
You were studying at Juilliard.
Yeah, I had a really great life. But, you know, I think, as Candace said, it's anyone who's affected by this disease, anyone who sees this, really has changed. It is something that is... people just don't appreciate until you experience it.
So why is that, Candace? What makes the patient different?
It's something that you have to experience, but it's that you get so much from it. You get to travel this really amazing road with them. It's quite a journey, and it's you get a lot from the patient. You get the stories. You get to see them in their best and worst moments, and it is quite an amazing journey to be on, and it really is humbling. You get a lot from that experience, and you get to give so much of yourself to the patient too, and it really is quite an amazing thing to be a part of. It's an amazing thing to do.
Candace, what do you say to families? How do you help them?
You know, it's a lot of hope and humor.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you have to take it day by day and try not to focus too much on the future, because you just have to look at it with hope and know that it is day by day and week by week. And, you know, if you have plans for next year, you know, make them for this year, but still keep your plans for next year and, you know, take it with hope that, you know, there will be a next year. But not wait, you know, too long to do what it is that, you know, you want to do. And use a lot of humor. And I think humor is extremely important to make everything a little easier.
All right. Candace Becker-O'Hara is clinical nurse coordinator at Neuro-Oncology at Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We're talking about brain cancer and its treatment with Dr. Greg Foulkes, Dr. Anthony Blau. So are the tumors in the brain and the brainstem, are there? There's a long list of them when I look at this brain cancer page. Is that different than other cancers? There's just many more kinds of brain cancers?
Yeah, just to expand on that a little bit. So there are 120 odd numbers of names of things that are tumors that arise from cells of the brain. But the most common form of primary brain cancer is the astrocytoma, and particularly the high-grade glioblastoma form, grade 4 of astrocytoma. And within that type of tumor, that's what Tony was saying, within that type of tumor, we see tremendous amount of differences from patient to patient. So certainly you see differences between a astrocytoma and, say, another type of tumor, meningioma, that can be malignant. In rare cases, you can see big differences there too. But even within a tumor type, you can see differences. I think of every single patient as sort of a detective when he approaches a case or a mystery. They each have their own unique clues that we should be paying attention to, documenting, studying, collecting, so that as we move from patient to patient, we can develop a collective body of knowledge that tells us what might work best in an individual patient. It's a new approach to how we look at this disease.
We're looking at brain cancer with Dr. Greg Foulkes. Environmental factors, cell phone. What do you guys do? And the dangers of cell phone,
yes,
perhaps, to the brain.
So that's a long subject, but I would just say that the data that's available does not support in any sort of statistically provable way that there is a link between cell phone use and brain cancer. But having said that, even the science behind it, if you look at the type of radiation that is given off by a cell phone, which is similar to what's given off by a microwave, that doesn't and never has supported forming cancer in any tissue. So I think it's unlikely. Other environmental causes are not known in adults. So it's not something I always say to patients that you've done to yourself, unlike smoking or other things that can cause cancer. But in children, certainly, there are known causes, particularly radiation in children, which have been historically given for things such as head lice, caused cancer to occur later in life.
This is from Risa. She writes, I'm a nurse working end-of-life care. Brain cancer in patients often lose their personalities or have terrible emotional symptoms, and families lose their loved ones twice. You are all concurring with that. You see that happen with a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to that first. You know, there certainly, I think, any nonprofit brain tumor center in this area would take care of patients who don't have the means to pay for the treatments. But there's so much more to this, to how this affects their life. And that's why the Integrative Patient Support Program is so important. This affects all aspects of your life because, of course, it's affecting your brain. That's your personality. It's how you think. It's how you can do your job and relate to your family and relate to your community. And that's something I learned early on, that we have to support the patients in this way because it's impossible for them to face this disease, to get the treatments that we need to give to keep them well when their life is crumbling around them in such a way.
We heard Candace talk about laughter. What do you help people do with imaging, sort of things they do, positive attitudes, laughter? How does that help people deal with this?
The best medicine for this disease is something called the Seattle Brain Cancer Walk. Mm-hmm. If our patients, anyone who's been affected by this disease, family members, patients, come down to that walk, what they'll see are 2,500 people who are all gathered in support of their cause. They'll see the survivors. They wear green shirts. We have about 40 of them that were there last year. Who are doing well, who have their life intact, who have really done very well with this disease. And that's such an inspiration to in one day go and meet these people, to visit, to see their families, to see all the people who love and care for them gathered together to support the cause. I wish we could do that every day. In a way, it gives you a clue as to how we need to help these patients. We need to do more in that way, as Candace was describing it, to help them every day face a disease which is very high risk and yet still retains this small glimmer of hope, which is so important in how you approach every day of your life, that is still there for them.
That's Dr. Greg Foltz, a neurosurgeon who dedicated more than 25 years of his life studying the deadliest cancer, brain cancer. Greg Foltz died this past Thursday, shortly after he received a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, the second deadliest cancer. To honor his work, Katie Sewell wanted to revisit that interview with him done by Steve Scher in 2011.
You heard him talking there about the Seattle Brain Cancer Walk. The Brain Cancer Walk helps fund the research that Dr. Foltz was doing. This year, the walk is on September 21st. You can learn more about how to participate by visiting braincancerwalk.org. I also put a link on kuow.org/weekday there. And there's also a fund that's been set up to accept donations to continue Dr. Foltz's work. There's a link to that fund at our website as well. Or you can contact the Swedish Medical Center Foundation at 206-386-3527.
It's 9:29. In a minute here, King County Executive Dow Constantine joins us to talk about the state Senate's inability to deliver transportation solutions. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Imagine 21 rounds of electroshock therapy.
Even after the second, third, fourth, fifth.
Nothing.
Sixth. Nothing.
Seventh.
Nothing.
Eighth.
Nothing. But at 10, I definitely noticed something. I definitely felt there had been a change.
When lives change in an instant. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evening MBA and ISM program at Seattle Pacific University, hosting an open house on Tuesday, July 9th from 4:30 until 6 p.m. More information and registration is available at spu.edu/business. Seattle Pacific University, engaging the culture, changing the world.
...68 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 82 this afternoon with lots of sun. It's 9:30. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Are you stuck in a music listening rut? We're going to help you rise up out of that rut. Local electronic music with an aeronautical theme. That's 10 minutes away.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday. You've heard by now that the state legislature passed its budget and left Olympia over the weekend. What they didn't do was vote on a $10 billion state transportation plan, and that puts King County Metro's transit services at risk. General Manager Kevin Desmond says about 17% of current Metro service routes could be cut. He also says Metro would need an additional $15 million a year to keep up with growing demand for transit Service. King County Executive Dow Constantine joins us now. And this was your top priority, I think, for the legislative session, Dow Constantine, and they did nothing. So now what?
Well, Marcy, yes, it was our top priority. It's one of the most important things we do to support the economy. 43% of the people coming into and out of downtown Seattle on a daily basis do so on a bus. So the Senate Republicans' refusal to move forward on responsible transportation funding is going to be a real drag on our economy and a terrible problem for an awful lot of folks. What's next? Well, we don't have a lot of options. Counties and cities are creatures of the state government. The state government, for the most part, wanted to move forward, providing us local options so the people of King County could decide to keep their buses on the road. This small group of legislators in the Senate blocked that. We are going to be working on what the cuts will look like as they're phased in next year. We're going to continue working with this broad coalition of business leaders, environmental leaders, local government officials, to identify anything we can do to reduce the impacts and, of course, to advocate for the funding that really is needed to keep the buses running.
In a press release that came out this morning, you said, I'm asking those partners that you just named to reconvene in the coming weeks to identify the next steps to protect our regional economy. The bus service that people depend on to get to work is one thing, but can you talk more specifically about economic impacts of the fact that this transportation budget didn't pass?
Well, sure. I mean, the reason that all the major businesses in our region were advocating for a transportation package for both roads and transit is that the transportation system is the lifeblood of our economy. It allows the freight to move, it allows workers to reliably get to and from their jobs. So companies like Microsoft, who have thousands upon thousands of people commuting every day, need our transit system to function. Companies like Boeing needed the funding we were asking for in order to be able to get workers to and from that 737 plant. We're going to bring these partners together, and you know, once they've recovered a little bit from the legislative session, and talk about what other options we might have available. We'll be talking with the governor and with others in Olympia about the possibility of crafting another deal that could have a chance of passing. But if we wait until next year, it will be too late to begin collecting the funds to keep our buses running. We're on a two-year timeline with temporary funding that was provided by the legislature, and it is going to run out early next year.
How early next year? Are we talking cuts in January?
We have three annual service changes, one in the spring, and we'll probably begin with that service change rather than having all the cuts happen mid-year. The funding runs out May or June of next year. We do believe that there are a lot of folks in this county who understand the importance of our transit and roads, and there's broad public support for maintaining those and maintaining our quality of life. But we need the state legislature to get out of our way and allow us to succeed.
So, again, to reiterate, what didn't pass was not a specific tax, but it was the authority for King County to put that measure to the voters?
That's right. We were not asking the legislators to raise taxes. We were asking them to allow us to put that question to our own voters here.
And as I understand it, both Pierce and Snohomish counties were looking for the same thing. Have you worked together with county executives from those two counties?
Yes. I've worked with both of those counties, and our representatives in Olympia work together on a daily basis. Those counties have suffered significant transit cuts. 2 years ago, King County was able to show the legislature the dramatic reforms and improvements we've made in Metro Transit, and that's why we were granted the ability to raise funds for 2 years to keep our buses running. Those other counties, though, are part of our economy, and they're part of this big metropolitan area, and we need their transit systems to function, too. An awful lot of workers come and go across these county borders.
So specific to Metro and King County Transit, will those 17% cuts be felt countywide, or are you targeting particular areas for cuts?
We went through a long process of creating objective criteria for the addition or the subtraction of service that was based on the recommendations of a countywide panel. So our service is based on productivity as well as geographic and economic fairness. So when we apply the measures of the current service and we look at the criteria, it will show us which routes need to be reduced or eliminated or consolidated. There's no escaping the fact that this level of cuts is going to have a dramatic impact on an awful lot of folks, far more than 17% of our riders, because while some will see their routes eliminated, others will see overcrowding or less frequent service. And it is going to be a real burden. It's going to slow down our economic recovery.
How is this going to affect the new Rapid Ride routes?
Well, Rapid Ride was funded by a vote of the people of King County several years ago, and the biggest part of that is deploying these high-capacity bus routes in corridors. And those will be able to continue as they are funded by the dedicated source of funding voted for by the people, a tenth of a cent sales tax. They are also very productive. They carry an awful lot of people much more efficiently than the more neighborhood-oriented service. So those are unlikely to be reduced in the application of the criteria I described.
But they may be likely more crowded as people find ways to those corridor routes.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, as often as I hear people complaining about a lack of service in their neighborhood or their rural town, I even more frequently hear about people saying their buses are just so crowded they have to wait for two or three coaches to pass before they're able to get on and get to work. And that is just an indication of how our economy needs this service, and really, as Kevin Desmond said, needs to have more of it to account for population growth, economic growth, and the shift in people's behavior, the desire to get out of their cars and get on a bus.
You mentioned, County Executive Constantine, that you might speak with the governor. Is there anything that could be done before the next regular legislative session convenes January 2014?
Well, you know, there's no saying what can happen over the course of the year. The legislature, of course, can be called into session at any time, but I think it would be very difficult to do that unless you had ironclad agreement as to what was going to happen. You wouldn't want to go to the trouble and expense of calling the legislature into session just to get back in the same dynamic that we struggled with for the last several months. But, you know, getting out there and telling the story of what's really going to happen and alerting our riders, as we are this morning, to the impending cuts will help. It's just a handful of Republican state senators, really here in King County, in fact, who could have completely changed the complexion of this legislative session and this particular transportation measure. And I'm very hopeful that their constituents will let them know that they're concerned about cuts to the buses and the continued deterioration of our roads.
Are you advocating some kind of public action? Is that what you're saying? Besides calling your legislator?
I'm advocating that people take a look at what this inaction by the legislature will mean to their economic future, and that they let people know what they want to have happen, let their elected representatives know what they want to have happen. And I believe that the people of this county strongly support funding the basic infrastructure that has allowed us to have this excellent quality of life here that we enjoy.
Dow Constantine is King County Executive. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's a new music recommendation, and it's just a minute away on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from BECU, the member-owned not-for-profit credit union, offering a range of home loan products, including conventional and jumbo mortgages. Details at BECU.org, an equal housing opportunity lender, federally insured by the NCUA.
It's going to be another warm day in Seattle. Not as warm as yesterday, though. Today's predicted high is 82 with lots of sun. Currently 68 degrees in Seattle. And it's going to be warm and sunny all week, so you know what? Take a hike. No, really, if you want to take a hike, we're going to get a recommendation in 10 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday. It's really easy to get stuck in a rut, whether it's what you cook for dinner or the route you take when you're biking home. Maybe your particular rut is musical. Every Tuesday on Weekday, we've been bringing in people who have some great ideas to help move you out of your listening comfort zone. And today we welcome Jonathan Zwickel to the studio. He writes about music for City Arts Magazine. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And you wanted to talk about electronic music. Before we hear any of it, I have to ask what that is, because isn't all music these days sort of electronic?
No.
Okay,
no,
define.
I mean, there certainly is a lot of electronics used in the production of pop music.
Right.
The stuff that I brought in and that I'm thinking of specifically is almost entirely made on laptops or other digital machines, or also analog gear that might be 20, 30, 40 years old, but that typically doesn't involve guitars, drums, bass, things that you normally associate with pop music.
So I'm thinking of Moog synthesizer as an early rendition of this?
Sure, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Are there characteristics beside the fact that it's not made with a recognizable instrument per se that define electronic?
You know, it's I think it's way more diverse than being able to sort of classify it or characterize it with a sentence or a style. You know, and that's one thing that I wanted to talk about is that I think a lot of people expect electronic music to sound like techno, quote unquote.
Right.
Where it's a 4-4 steady beat made for a dance floor, perhaps. And that exists for sure. That's definitely a major component of electronic music. But there's also a ton of other styles. You know, it used to be that I think that kind of music was made primarily for the purpose of dancing, you know, mm-hmm. disco and that sort of thing in the 70s and 80s. These days, I think it's grown way past that. And yes, there's plenty of dance music that's being made, but then also there's a lot of sort of ambient and more sort of relaxed electronic music also. So the stuff that I brought in, I think, spans both of those styles.
And one last question before we hear something.
Sure.
So that we can really tease people's appetites along. Seattle, are we a hotbed of electronica?
Absolutely, for sure.
Really?
You know, and that's something that I think might be overlooked when people think about Seattle. You know, we tend to be a one-note town, and I think we're a bit mired in our musical history to some extent. And the fact is that this is a place where there are a ton of innovators making the music and also coming here to perform it. One of the reasons why Seattle is such a hotbed for this stuff is Decibel Festival, which is a festival of electronic music that's been going on for 10 years, actually.
Really?
This will be the 10th year, yeah, come September. And, you know, this is a festival where, you know, there's 80-some countries represented. I mean, it's a huge international destination that was built up from a tiny underground event to something that is now, you know, one of the more prestigious electronic music events around the world.
We're talking with Jonathan Zwickel, who writes about music for City Arts Magazine. And today, now that everybody's appetite for electronica has been whetted, you've brought in two bands who have composed music on a sort of aeronautical theme. I guess that fits with Seattle, Boeing City.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. I've been thinking about the names of these artists. And, you know, I think there's one is called Airport and the other is Miniature Airlines. And I guess, you know, there's some maybe sort of retro futurist element to both of those names, in that, you know, there was a time when air travel was sort of considered the wave of the future.
Right.
You know, I also think that a lot of times you can sort of, you know, marinate on a band name or just sort of contemplate it. And a lot of times I think artists just choose these things totally randomly. You know, or in a state of mind that might be, you know, somewhat altered, and, you know, maybe it's an inside joke. And so, you know, you might just, they're impressionist, perhaps.
Okay. Well, let's start with this band. It's a band, I guess, Miniature Airlines.
It's actually one guy.
Okay. It's a person, Miniature Airline.
Right.
Even though he's plural.
Right. His name is Dylan Abbott, and he's been making this music for a while. I just turned on to this maybe 6 months or so ago. There's a local label that's called Pleasure Boat Records that's been around for a little while. They actually have a great tagline.
You wrote it down?
I wrote it down, yeah, because I wasn't going to memorize it. Party music for the apocalypse. Since 2008, which is great. And although I wouldn't necessarily characterize Miniature Airlines as party music, But this, I think, sort of dwells in a almost in a pop music realm.
This cut is called "Unmoved by Jazz," and this is Miniature Airlines. Let's listen to a little bit of it. So that cut is called "Unmoved by Jazz, Miniature Airlines." Jonathan Zwickel, it sounds like this artist is a little bit moved by jazz, just slightly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think you might be right. I imagine the title is tongue in cheek.
It's interesting to listen to all the layers that one person can put together, because there's definitely a piano sound in there, but it's totally electronic.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my understanding, is that it's mostly a laptop and then also some MIDI controllers where this guy Dylan can input into his laptop with a guitar, keyboards, piano, that sort of thing.
I guess I have seen people perform electronic music, if that's the right verb for what you do when you bring all your equipment onto a stage, but do you get the same experience seeing it live as we might listening to it?
I think it really depends on the performer. I've never seen Miniature Airlines live, so I'm not exactly sure what they bring to the stage. The next guy, Airport, I have seen, and he's kind of a maniac with all the gear that he has on a tiny little table, you know, just sort of overwhelmed with wires and cables and
that's what I imagine.
Filters and amps and like, all sorts of strange stuff that you can't really tell exactly what's going on, and yet he's manipulating all of these dials and, you know, knobs as if, I mean, he knows what he's doing, but it's kind of inscrutable from the audience perspective.
Well, so let's talk about Airport. That's another one guy band?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Who is this?
His name is Jason Kochin. I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name. Super talented guy. He plays in Airport, and he's also in another band called Midday Vale. He plays bass in Midday Vale, which is a psych rock band, sort of in a more traditional rock and roll vein.
Meaning he plays an actual instrument.
He does.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, I would also consider, the various pieces of electronic outboard gear instruments as well.
And probably
maybe in a less traditional vein.
Right. Probably everybody who's a musician out listening is saying, oh, Marcy, those are instruments. So this is a long song we're going to hear part of. The song is called Sweat.
Yeah.
Okay. So very appropriate for the week. Let's listen to Airport's tune Sweat, or at least part of it. So, Jonathan Zwickel, what's different right off the bat for me, this sounds very electronic, and whereas the Miniature Airlines tune felt tuneful, this one really seems kind of space age.
Uh-huh. Propulsive.
Yeah.
Yes, this is definitely more oriented towards the dance floor.
So this is...
This is, I would say, the other end of that spectrum that we were talking about. You know, this is dance music.
So in... just talk about the Decibel Festival, which is coming up this fall. I also, when I think of electronica, I think of sounds that are really sort of ambient. There's a lot of people I know, Seattle Phonographers Union, which is putting together sort of improvised sound, is are representative of a whole community of folks who who are creating mood, not so much as rhythm.
Sure.
Or what we think of more traditionally as song.
Yeah, and Decibel does incorporate that style as well.
So
with their more, they have sit-down shows at various theaters around town. So yeah, you go in and you're sort of saturated with the music, basically. And it might be in that more sort of ambient vein that you're talking about.
So if I were, excited, I'm like, wow, I want to get one of these, or I want to hang out. Are there clubs in town that specialize in electronic nights, or maybe all electronic music?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that Airport is playing at the end of the month as part of a Debacle Records showcase. Debacle is a local label that specializes in strange experimental music of all varieties. They have a night called Motor, which I believe is monthly. And at the end of this month, July 25th, they're having a few artists perform at Pony, which is a really strange, dark, and exciting tiny little nightclub on Capitol Hill. And the nights that Debacle do there are always really, really fun, really enjoyable.
Well, Jonathan Zwickel, thank you so much for introducing us to music that I, at least, have not had a lot of exposure to. So we're listening right now to the end of Airport Sweat. We also heard Unmoved by Jazz by, these are both guys, but we'll call them bands, Miniature Airlines. You can read more from Jonathan at City Arts Magazine. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Marcy. I appreciate it.
This is Weekday on KUOW. That kind of is in keeping with the hot, hot weather. It's Tuesday. It has been hot. We're told it's going to cool off, but it hasn't happened yet. Michael Fagan with West Coast Weather LLC joins us as he does every week. And Michael, you want to start with the weather forecast before we talk about how to walk around when it's super hot?
That's right. Well, we are looking at a cooling trend somewhat today. One thing, we will not be breaking any records today like we did yesterday, but still warm, low 80s. It depends when we get this marine push, but certainly cooler on Wednesday and Thursday. Wednesday highs in the mid-70s, Thursday 32.
Is it really?
72.
72. So while still really quite pleasant, nothing like 89.
Right, and then holiday weekend, Friday through the weekend, 70. So more of the typical low clouds in the morning than mostly sunny in the afternoon, and not in the record-breaking temperature range. So the first hike is a bit of a drive, but this is a phenomenal hike. It's just east of White Pass, Round Mountain. And with the holiday weekend, maybe go out there and car camp for a couple nights and take a day hike. Or you could drive there for the day. From Seattle, it's about a three-hour drive, so you want to leave plenty of time. This is, again, east of White Pass. This is Round Mountain, and it's not that long of a hike to get to this old lookout. It's 2.5 miles one way, 1,700-foot gain, so you do get a workout. You'll see from the blog, the views are phenomenal. You get Mount Rainier, Mount Adams, the Goat Rocks, Rim Rock Lake, so it's wonderful. Hike with wonderful views. Some wildflowers are out, and you'll need Forest Service Pass for this, and this is Green Trails Map 303. Now, if you want to hike today and looking at a close-in hike that will offer you some shade, Twin Falls is certainly a nice hike outside of North Bend. This is a kid-friendly hike. It's in the shade, and on the Marcy fitness scale, this is not a lot of effort, so this is a scale of 2 with 5 being the hardest. So this is a pleasant hike on a warm day like this. You won't be overexerting yourself, and you'll need a Discover Pass, and this is Green Trails Map 206S. So we have two hikes to choose from over the next several days, so I think these would both offer great hiking opportunities.
Now, if people go over to Round Mountain near White Pass, it's going to be warmer than it is on this side of the mountains anyway. So you have some quick tips for hot weather hiking.
Right. What you want to do is you don't want to do what I did Sunday. I got a late start, and we hiked up this trail at noon, and that. Yeah. So, but we did pace ourselves. There's when you are out early, when you are out on a hot day, you can't always get an early start. But that's the best thing you can do is early start. Find some shade, take some breaks. I like to hydrate. Maybe have a liter worth of water on the way to the trail. Then certainly take about 3 liters for the hike up. And you also want one of the sports drinks with the electrolytes. That's really critical on a warm day. And again, finding the shade, finding trails that are more north-facing. This Round Mountain actually is north-facing, so it would be a little cooler than a direct heat from the south. So just some common sense. And we did put these suggestions on the blog. And I always like to have a cooler in the trunk of the car with some cold water. That certainly hits the spot after a long day out in the sun.
So shade and hydration.
Yes, and yeah, you want to find a hike that has some shade, because if you're just open in the sun, that's you're just asking for heat stroke. So just plan accordingly.
Be prepared. Michael Fagan recommended two hikes, Round Mountain near White Pass, a longer trip, so maybe over the weekend, and Twin Falls near North Bend in the shade, better for today. Thanks so much.
You bet. Talk to you next week.
Okay. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagan's Weather World, gives us some good hike suggestions to match the weekend weather forecast. And that forecast is for a marine air cooling trend. So we're not talking about cold, but we're talking about significantly cooler weather. And now, the sound of the day. I was listening to some tape from the Pixar movie WALL-E. This is not that, though. Sounds like it.
Sounds like a robotic insect.
Well, have you ever heard something and thought, what the heck? Where is that coming from? And that's what our listener, Shy, thought when this sound was buzzing around, or whatever verb you would use. It turns out it was a bottle of Perrier water with a cap not completely closed, so it sounds like carbonation is seeking out through the rim. But maybe that is what they used, those Pixar folks, Bernard, when they were animating WALL-E. What interesting sounds do you hear in the world around you? Record 30 seconds and send that sound to us along with the story behind it. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. Bernard, you really like that sound, I can tell.
I do.
It's kind
charming.
It's fizzy. Now that we know what it is. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk about what's happening in Egypt and why do Americans really care about the British royals? After all, Princess Kate or Countess Kate or Duchess Kate, I forget her title, about to have a new royal baby. We're going to hear why some people think we care about it.
It's 9:59. We're just a minute away from NPR News headlines. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support from 5-Hour Energy.
The real-life Marie Duplessis gave rise to the fictional heroine of a famous French play, a great Italian opera, and several movies.
Performance history has always made her the sort of older woman with the young boy, and that's the way I think it's played now. But she was a kid.
The Paris courtesan, who inspired a century of stories later, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.